I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Leanne George joins me now, along with Steve May. She's co-authored a fascinating and timely book, The Ego Boom, Why the World Really Does Revolve Around You. You see in advertising how everything from computers to burgers and shoes to our charitable tendencies seem customized to our desires, constantly connecting to our ego. We have become narcissists, and this book shows us how we became so, why, and where we're headed. Leanne George is a senior editor at Maclean's. The book is published by Key Porter and retails for $27.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Leanne George. Good morning, Ms. George.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
When you talk about this current generation that's mired in all of this, what age are we looking at, and sort of when were they born, and how old are they, et cetera?
We're sort of looking at people who are about 30 and under. So those who grew up in the sort of late 70s, 80s, and 90s, because that's really the time when these sort of self-esteem programs were really kind of entrenched in the schools in a totally new way. So to the extent that, you know, to a certain extent, we've all been immersed in a lot of this messaging that you talk about for a long time, but it's this younger generation that really has never existed outside of it.
See, and this is why the book connected with me. I'm 26, mm-hmm. and I see this all around me.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that I'm not as materialistic, perhaps, as my friends who mm-hmm. have to get the newest gadget, have to get, the house in the burbs, etc.
Right.
But I guess we're all a part of this. I asked Steve when I talked to him, you're both journalists.
Yes.
And you've written this book, you've talked about this sort of stuff in your articles and columns in Maclean's. As journalists as observers of all this, do you find that you're looking at us perhaps cynically, or are you just as stuck in all of this as we are?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, we're not that far outside of this demographic ourselves. I should start off by saying, you know, I certainly grew up at a time when these programs are a big part of my schooling as well. I think that part of the reason we decided to write this book in the first place was because we were both finding ourselves really, we kind of started to recognize this sort of you-self that we talk about in the book, and we found ourselves really, that it was actually really persuasive. And, you know, one of my early experiences in the course of researching this book was buying a condominium. And the sale there, this idea that you're sort of buying a life that is custom created for you, and you'll put your unique signature on your suite, and, you know, it's basically you'll create an environment that will conform to you. That's really the message when you look at a lot of the way condos are marketed in cities across North America. I found myself so seduced by this message, and I think part of what got us really interested in the book was the fact that this message was so ubiquitous, but also so seductive to all of us.
So when we read this book, do you think we can arm ourselves against these sorts of marketers?
Well, I think what's really interesting, again, is once you start to see it, I mean, what we talk about, again, is something we call the U-cell, and it's the shift in marketing messaging. So, again, messaging used to be more about pointing out the consumer shortcomings and then suggesting a product that they could use to help them, you know, improve. Of course, they could never truly improve enough, so it kept them buying in perpetuity. And what we're seeing now is, of course, this new affirmational messaging, this what we're calling the U-cell, which is the message that you're already special, unique, and perfect the way you are, and here's a product that will help you broadcast your specialness to the world. So I think that once we are able to kind of define the parameters of this cell and this message, which, you know, we've tried to do in the book, and you start to see it everywhere, and you kind of start to see it for what it is, and it loses a lot of its potency, because as you find yourself being kind of seduced by it, you kind of recognize, well, this is just another, this is just another appeal to my vanity, and suddenly it doesn't seem to carry as much weight. It just loses a lot of its potency when you kind of identify it for what it is.
Do you think we realize the consequences of all this, of buying to express ourselves rather than for what we want or need? That I mean, we look at the debt crisis and this economic situation that we're all in.
Yeah.
It seems sort of a symptom of that, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, no, I don't think we do realize it, because I think because so much of advertising now talks to us in the language of self-esteem, we think that it's a good thing. You know, we think that a lot of these products are allowing us to build a sense of self. And, of course, the real irony is that, you know, the more we buy into this sort of customization message, the more homogenous we all tend to become, because when we're all buying the same products to express how special and unique we are, you know, take the iPod, for instance. It's offered in, you know, 8 to 10 different colors, and there's this sense that if I buy the pink one or I buy the blue one, it's expressing something unique and special about me. But at the end of the day, we're all buying the same iPod to express how special and unique and individual we are. So there's this real homogeneity that sort of comes into play. Reverse, the consequences are sort of the opposite of what you would think, that we're all expressing ourselves in some way, when in fact we're all kind of buying into the same message.
Do you see some light at the end of the tunnel? Do you think we'll get away from this? Do you think these hard times, as most people think that we're in now, will get us out of this thinking?
Well, I do. I think, again, what you said earlier in terms of debt, I think once we internalize the idea, we've really become accustomed to this notion that luxury is for the masses. That's something that's been so pervasive in the last few years, that everyone should be able to have luxury, and that it's not just for rich people. And I think once we really internalize this idea that we deserve things, regardless of whether or not we can afford them, that's when we get into trouble debt-wise. And I think, with so many people feeling the squeeze right now, I think we're going to, just by necessity, have to really start to reevaluate a lot of our consumer decisions. And we're hoping that this book is sort of one tool that people can use in terms of, you know, evaluating their own consumer choices and maybe making choices that are better for them.
You draw a line in the book to Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, and why he was wrong in telling us growing up that we were special. That sort of thinking leads to the entitlement that we all feel that we have now.
Yeah, it's funny, because a lot of what we're finding now is that a lot of the child psychologists and people who study education, who, you know, they're looking back, and in hindsight, what we were trying to do by implementing all of these self-esteem language and tools and programs in the schools, and what we were trying to do is create this sense that, you know, young people should feel good about themselves at any cost. So we should strip away competition, you know, and eliminate challenges to people's sense of self-worth, and protect young people from failure, and sort of lavish them with praise. And in hindsight, this is not how you actually cultivate real self-esteem, because real self-esteem is much more resilient than that. And it's much more about being able to cope with failure and disappointment, and to rebound, and to, you know, take criticism and use it constructively, and to have a realistic assessment of your own skills and strengths and weaknesses. So, you know, that's what real self-esteem is. But what we were doing, what was happening in the schools, is this constant sort of relentless self-focus that needs constant it puts you in a position of needing constant, it needs constant feeding. So you need affirmation, you need validation. We had parents doing that in a lot of cases. And I think what's happening now is that a lot of this marketing messaging is stepping in and filling that void. You know, it's the you're okay message over and over again. You're good enough and special enough as you are. We're kind of paying for it now.
And what did the research that you all did tell us about how we handle authority?
How we handle authority? Well, I mean, part of it is that what's happened with this, with the ego boom, is so much of it is about handing over authority to the consumer. Of course, it's a sort of a false sense of authority. But again, you look at something as simple as your burger, your way. the Harvey campaign. You know, it's really about telling the consumer that, you know, we're not the expert on burgers, you're the expert. And you tell us what a great burger is, and that's the burger we're going to sell you. So, again, we internalize this message in all kinds of realms. We're, you know, it's a false sense, because ultimately, you know, they're still making your burger and they're still providing you with maybe 8 condiments to choose from. But there's this sense of ownership. And, you know, a lot of research that we came across, one study in particular, they found that people are willing to pay up to 25% more for a product that they feel that they've had a hand in creating, even if it's sort of in very insignificant ways. You know, even if it's just a matter of ticking off a few boxes, like, for example, when you're buying a condominium and you get to pick this flooring versus that flooring or these backsplash tiles and not those ones, you know, you have this sense of authority that you are the design authority there, even though the samples have all been pre-selected and there's really not very much choice, and it's kind of dummy-proof. But the consumer now has become accustomed to being told that they know best what's right for them. And it's just something that we crave hearing it. We crave hearing it from our politicians, and we crave hearing it from, you know, in a lot of cases, from spiritual leaders now.
Which leads us to Oprah. How do you think what blame do you think she deserves in all this?
Well, it's funny, because we really don't see it as, it's not really so much about blame. I mean, so much of this, all of this is, a lot of this, I should say, is very well-intentioned. I think the idea of, you know, living your best life, as Oprah said, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. I think the only time it becomes sort of problematic is when we're buying sort of a false notion of authority and of individuality. And we're kind of deluding ourselves a little bit when it comes to, you know, one of the big phenomenons of the last couple of years was the book The Secret, which Oprah endorsed on her show. And it was really a spirituality text that really encouraged people to think of themselves as sort of a divine force that can essentially make the world conform to them. And anything they want, all they need to do is just to sort of focus on it, and it will actualize. It will materialize. So again, there's so much focus now on the world conforming to me. And I think that there's this sort of fine line between self-actualization, becoming the best possible version of yourself that you can be, doesn't necessarily mean indulging all of your whims. And I think that's where there's this kind of blurring of lines.
In the book, you talk about this survey that Drew Pinsky did. He's the sort of Hollywood doctor, isn't he, on TV?
Yes.
What was his survey about in terms of, I forget now what it was. It was skill versus fame?
It was about fame. Yeah, it was a really interesting study on fame and narcissism. And because he had this radio call-in show where he would have celebrity guests, he was the first academic to be able to have that kind of access to celebrities. And so he gave about 200 celebrities a test, basically tested them on the the widely used narcissism diagnostic test. He wanted to determine, first of all, are people inherently narcissistic? Do people become narcissistic because they're famous, or do inherently narcissistic seek out fame? And he and his colleagues, that the latter turned out to be true, and there was this very interesting correlation between the level of technical skill that a given celebrity had and how high they scored on the narcissism test. So it actually was an inverse relationship. So basically, the more skilled you were, the more modest you were. So musicians tended to score fairly low, whereas the reality TV show stars, who had very little actual skill, scored very high on that test. They were actually the kinds of people who wanted to be famous for the sake of being famous. And we know that that's kind of a modern phenomenon, this idea of fame for the sake of fame. And, you know, the internet has provided us sort of infinite number of opportunities to broadcast ourselves and to seek out this kind of mass adulation and attention.
So considering these technological advancements, say Facebook and YouTube and everything else, do you find that we're not as socially connected?
Well, I think
I guess we are socially connected, but the connections that we make are not really that they're insignificant, really.
Well, there are different types of connections. I mean, certainly we have, you know, I think it's a tough thing to quantify, but I do think that a lot of the relationships that the sort of new types of relationships that we're creating online are much more about broadcasting, and they're much more sort of unidirectional in the sense that someone might have a Facebook and they'll post their photos and they'll post they'll send out updates on what they're doing in their lives, and they'll have a list of all of their, you know, quote unquote friends, but it's very much about piecing together your own sort of brand portrait on a screen. It's very much about broadcasting you and shaping sort of brand you online. Whereas the emphasis is kind of certainly in those, a lot of those social networking sites, the emphasis is really off kind of in-depth, two-way conversations. But you know, it's a difficult thing to quantify because, of course, technology helps us in communicate in all sorts of other ways. So, but I do think the internet itself, and certainly a lot of these social networking sites, are really about opportunities to broadcast a version of yourself to the world.
So do you think that we should be more humble, that we could do with some humility?
Well, I think we could all do with some humility. I mean, I think it's a difficult thing because, again, we're all to some extent a product of the environment that we've grown up in. And, you know, when we talked earlier about this sort of younger generation, I mean, we've been getting these messages on all fronts, you know, in schools and from our parents. And in the marketplace, I mean, 20 years ago, I mean, before the 90s, really, the tween market didn't exist. It was created to educate a group of, you know, 7, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds about their importance in the world as consumers and as opinion makers. And so it's very difficult to, you know, to point the finger at young people. It's not that there's any sort of inherent failing, but I do think that we've all been sort of steeped in this messaging for such a long time, and it's really a perfect symbiosis of wanting to hear the message and in particular marketers who are very eager to tell us that, to give us that message, because there's a lot of money to be made, it turns out, from stroking people's egos.
So did you see a change in future generations, though? Like one wonders, will we just market younger, to younger people? Like, will the demographics that marketers seek become younger, go younger than tweens, even?
That'll be very interesting to watch. It's very hard to say. I mean, I do think that any kind of message that is as pervasive as the U-cell has become eventually is going to lose its potency, just in the same way that the advertising that we were talking about, the old advertising, this sort of aspirational sell, the idea that you're not good enough and you need a product to make you better, has kind of lost its power with a lot of consumers, especially younger consumers who aren't really that vulnerable to that message. They're more comfortable, more accustomed to the message that they are good enough, and they don't really believe that they're not good enough. They believe that they are good enough. They just need the right tools to project that. And so, I think eventually we will become sort of inoculated against this idea. It will become hopefully it'll become transparent. And I think as you said earlier, with personal debt rising to the degree that it has and continues to, I think people are just out of necessity going to have to think more about their consumer impulses, about why they buy, and hopefully that propels us to become a little more self-reflective.
Did you have fun writing this book?
Oh, we had a great time writing this book. It was a really organic process. Steve and I started talking about it about 3 years ago, or a little over 3 years ago, and it was an idea that really just built up momentum in a very organic way, and all the pieces really kind of came together because we felt that, you know, lots of people write about the about consumerism, but we really wanted to identify a larger mindset, and I think it, you know, we're both very happy with the way it turned out, and we certainly worked well together as a team, so very pleased with it.
And the response to the book has been pretty good, hasn't it?
It has been. Yeah, I think, you know, what we're really hoping is that people would see a lot of their everyday lives in this book and maybe feel that a lot of these ideas were familiar, but perhaps they'd never really thought of it in this way, because that's how the process was for us. Of kind of defining the UCL. It was sort of identifying these things in our own lives and recognizing patterns there.
Well, congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The book is called The Ego Boom, Why the World Really Does Revolve Around You, $27.95 from Key Porter, co-authored with Steve Mache, Leanne George on the line. I'm Joseph Plunta.